I'm Eric Allen for KLCC. Classical chamber music and Chicago blues harmonica have found common ground in Corky Siegel's chamber blues since back in the 1960s. That inspired merger continues on the band's new release, Different Voices, which also includes other diverse elements from the saxophone of jazz legend Ernie Watts to the human beatboxing and vocals of Matthew Santos and Indian percussion from tabla master Sandeep Das. Corky Siegel's Chamber Blues will appear at the Jakewood Concert Hall in Eugene on Saturday, February 3rd. Corky Siegel is with me from his studios in Chicago. Thanks for your time today, Corky.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Well, was there an original aha moment long ago when you noticed that common ground between classical music and Chicago blues?
Yes, there were two. The first one, and let me give just a touch of background, coming out of my first gig at Pepper Show Lounge on 43rd and Vincennes. Me and Jim Schwall were the only white kids anywhere for miles around. And somehow we got this gig where we played every Thursday night from 9 at night till 4 in the morning. We're just learning the blues. We're taken under the wing by Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Otis Spann and Hound Dog Taylor and Willie Dixon, every great blues artists that came and sat in with us all night long, every Thursday night. What an amazing thing. So that's, you know, my blues roots. And I came out of that, and Jim Schwall and I then put together the Siegel Schwall Band. And here we are at Big John's. Butterfield had to go on the road, so they needed someone in that space. And there were a lot of auditions, and we got the gig. We're sitting in there. And this is the first aha moment of the juxtaposition of blues and classical. Night after night, this one guy comes into Big John's and actually follows us around to other clubs too, but this was happening at Big John's. And he shows up one night and he comes up to me, and I had never met him. And he comes up and he says, "Corky, I would like your band to jam with my band." And I'm thinking, who is this guy and who's his band? So I say, "Who's your band?" And he says, "The Chicago Symphony." And he was Maestro Seiji Ozawa, who wanted to bring the element of blues, who he felt would be the spark to enliven the classical form. He wanted to bring that into classical music, and he felt that we were the guys to do it. And so he asked me, "How are we going to do this?" And we got William Russo, composer, and they asked me, "How are we going to do this?" And that's how the whole partnership of creating this. And we said, "We're going to create something for everyone to not like." So that was, you know, where it all started. However, then, you know, we did our first performance with the Chicago Symphony, and then we recorded the first piece with the San Francisco Symphony, and we were invited to perform with symphonies all around the world. And Seiji used to say to me, "Corky, you must pursue this juxtaposition of blues and classical. The world needs it. It brings people together. It's important for music. It's important for the world. You must do this." Well, the truth is, I never pursued it, but it pursued me with a vengeance. And I started getting offers. I ended up, my first piece of music that I ever wrote, besides writing songs for Siegel Schwall and doing arrangements, was for the San Francisco Symphony. That was in 1975. And then from that, I got a commission to write for the National Symphony and the Grant Park Symphony. And I've done many commissions since then. I just finished a piece, that 45-minute symphonic blues piece that premiered in May with the Lancaster Orchestra, and one in 2007 that I've performed all over the world. But it wasn't until I started working on the piece for the National Symphony and the Grant Park Symphony that something happened to me. I fell in love with the juxtaposition of blues and classical. You know, here I was performing it. I loved it. Here I was writing it. But something happened. It was another aha moment that took me and grabbed me and wouldn't let go. And I said to my wife, I said, "You know, we should do this symphonic blues, but we should do it for chamber music because a symphony just won't fit in the bus." I said, "What do you think? It's going to change our lives." My wife and I were windsurfing. That's what we did most of the time, and skied. And I said, "It's going to change our lives." And she says, "Let's do it." And that was the aha moment. I felt like all of a sudden the brilliance of blues and classical coming together.
What do you find the common points to be between those two brilliant forms?
The common points are pitch, rhythm, harmony, tonality, timbre. Did I say rhythm, articulation, dynamics? All the musical elements, it's all the same for both forms. There are subtle differences, melodic differences, and a harmonic perspective that's slightly different. But this is what's amazing. The differences are a boon for any composer that would like to write something different. Every composer wants to write something different and original. And it's a little bit of a challenge to do that. But when you take two forms of music that are rarely seen together, it makes it really easy to do something different. You can't help. Everything you write is going to be different. So for chamber blues, the easiest thing to do is create a new experience for people and for myself. That's the easiest thing to do when it's really, in general, the most difficult thing to do in a composer and a musician's life is to offer something fresh.
How does that relate to the choices you've made on different voices, which also incorporates the percussion of India and vocal beatboxing, for example?
That's also the easy part. You know, throwing stuff together is easy. You just sort of do it. You go, hey, let's have some beatbox. Where should it go? Oh, let's put it here. That would be interesting. It's like a no-brainer to me. It's like, you know, when music comes out, a certain kind of music, it's bass, drums, guitar, and vocal, and other stuff. But the core group of any modern group, you know, is bass and drums and guitar. And if you want to do something different, the first thing you do is don't use bass, don't use drums, and don't use guitar. So, well, what am I? Well, string quartet, you know. I mean, so that's really the simple stuff. When I started with chamber blues, I started writing it in 1983. In those days, there was a lot of synthesizers being used in music. And so the idea of using a string quartet to me was amazing because it was so much the antithesis of synthesizer. It was a sweet wooden sound that when the string quartet would rehearse in my home and I'd lay on the floor and I'd have a headache, it would make the headache go away, you know? And it was just so sweet and so beautiful. And then I thought tabla is another wooden sound, acoustic wooden sound, so beautiful, so soothing, and so exciting too, like a full orchestra. And so the two together just seemed perfect for me. And I didn't have to use drums, and I didn't have to use any traditional percussion instruments. And I was able to do something in my genre completely different without having to even think about it. But the whole concept of string quartet and tabla and juxtaposing blues and classical in the environment of chamber music rather than symphonic, which is a lot of work, it just totally turned my world upside down. Just it hit me all in one moment while I was working on the National Symphony Commission and the Grand Park Commission. It just grabbed me, and it just hit me in a single moment, and that has created this whole musical life for me.
Creating that musical life is all about human relationships as well as musical relationships. And how do you approach finding the right players to express your vision?
A lot of auditions and looking for people who are leaders in kindness and joy. That's what we're looking for. So the first question I ask them is, so, do you like getting up at 3 a.m. to get in a plane? And I tell all the people at audition, I say, I just want to let you know one thing. We never pick the best person. So, if for some reason you end up being chosen, don't let it go to your head. So that gives you a good idea. But, you know, you mentioned humanitarian. You mentioned, you know, the people, a people thing. And to me, music has merged or morphed into a different animal. At one point, when I started out, it was to meet girls. You know, that was a primary motivation hidden behind the music. But then it became more about the music. And now it's become totally about people. Like the music isn't music anymore. It's relationship. It's the connection between love and humanity and the expression of that. It has passed music and it's become a relationship with love and humanity.
How does that end up affecting live performance then and the relationship you develop with the audience?
The relationship with the audience is something that's already there because we're already deeply connected with each other. So my job is to connect more deeply with myself and get deeper and deeper and deeper into what I do. And, you know, I certainly talk to the audience. I take part in that relationship. But my understanding is I don't have to do that. Digging deep into the music is really what I think everyone wants, inevitably. Want the artist to be the artist. I had a tour with Bob Hope. I did 6 performances with Bob Hope, and I asked him that question. I said, Bob, I got a problem. All the professional entertainers say you must read your audience. And I say, that makes no sense to me. I'm still not sure what I like. I'm still trying to read myself and trying to figure out what I like and digging and getting into. And he interrupted me. He says, Corky, let me tell you a story. I was on a performance. I was showing up an hour late because of travel problems. I get on stage. The audience is applauding. And I start telling my jokes. There's a few laughters here and there, a couple giggles here and there, but basically I am bombing. So I end my show short. People applaud. I get into my limo. I'm headed back to my hotel when I realized this was a special event for people who couldn't speak. They were mutes. He said, so Corky, and he points at me, don't ever try to read your audience. So, you know, in terms of relationship with an audience, it's already there. It exists before I was born. In terms of what message am I trying to send, I'm not trying to send a message. I'm trying to make sure that everything I do expresses love somehow.
And if it's a process of deepening within yourself, as you say, what areas of deepening are you still pursuing internally then?
Well, it's going to be a constant. Being a musician is an amazing thing, and being a performer is an amazing thing. You cannot play music and not be paying attention. The notes are there in front of you, and they're going by. And if you get caught up in what you've already done, you're missing it. And if you're worried about what you're about to do, you're missing it. It demands a certain amount of focus. Performing, you get on stage and you go, gee, I hope everyone loves this. I hope everyone likes me. It's a lifetime getting over that. But the rewards that come as you do get over that are just unbelievable. I mean, it's like I'm sitting there with goosebumps most of the time. You know, I've succeeded in that. You know, one wants to pick up their instrument or sing or play or do something at any level of skill. You want to get goosebumps. Otherwise, why bother? So anyway, I've been very successful at having very ecstatic experiences fairly constantly. I could still go deeper, and I could still be more consistent.
When you listen back then to different voices, how do you hear the manifestation of that deepening and what's resulted musically on that album?
This album, Different Voices, is the culmination of all my experiences from the Blues Masters in the 60s to Seiji Ozawa to my producing Joni Mitchell's last demo tape with Circle Game on it. Different Voices is a culmination, and one of the elements in Different Voices is it's fearlessness. Not that I'm trying to show people that I'm not afraid. It's not an expression of fearlessness. Fearlessness was a tool that allowed me to do a project like Different Voices. It allowed me to not worry about what people are going to think. I mean, we all have the problem of projecting. We're thinking, will they like it? Won't they like it? If we could just get rid of that, amazing things can happen. That's a message to myself that I offer to myself all the time. And it's a message that should go out to all artists who are suppressing their own creativity and expression because of our projection about what we think people might think. And the great news is that we're usually wrong.
Yes, I would argue that message applies to everyone, whether or not they consider themselves an artist. That's a pretty universal human lesson.
It is. We have our individuality to share, and it's the greatest gift we could offer the world. It was given to us. We could give it back.
Well, thank you for the gifts that you have brought in the music world. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate having the conversation today.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Corky Siegel, who'll bring his ensemble, Corky Siegel's Chamber Blues, to the Jaqua Concert Hall of the John G. Shedd Institute for the Arts in Eugene this Saturday, February 3rd. They're touring behind their new release, Different Voices. Corky Siegel will also be teaching a workshop at the Shedd Institute that day. Tickets and information at theshedd.org. Also see chamberblues.com for an extended version of this interview, klcc.org. For KLCC, I'm Eric Allen.